Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 22nd day of August 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call, and T-minus less than 3 months at this point from what will certainly be, one way or another, a cataclysmic firestorm in America with a K. And by that, I mean regardless of which of the two wannabe dictators, the one who doesn't really understand the Constitution or the one who positively detests it and everything associated with it, wins the everybody already knows it's rigged election come November. And yes, we know that half the country is going to blame the other half for it. Things are probably going to get ugly at least by November 4th, if not before. I'll admit I did struggle a bit with how to start off tonight, because there's obviously no way to do it without being at least, well, no, I guess I'd say at minimum, a whole lot cynical about what we're being fed nowadays. So, of course, I'm not going to try to soft pedal it. Wow, what a stinking fetid mess. And if you think I'm referring to the Communist Party USA convention this week, a.k.a. Democrats nuking the Constitution, you're right. But the key is, that's just one particularly nasty series of events among a whole bunch of them that make a similar point. And since I've already more or less gone there, let's start there. Because as far as the media is concerned, there's no doubt about it. The man who will be king, if they have anything to say about it, and they certainly intend to, along with their socialist big tech media masters like Gulag and Two Facebook and Twitter, Saint Joseph Biden will be the next dictator of these formerly free United States. Let's start with the Daily Mail out of the UK. Originally, I thought, hey, maybe if they're a few thousand miles further from Swamp Central, they could be more objective. But then it dawned on me after I read the headline, nah, those are subjects of the crown. They're used to having a king, so they are going to rave about this guy. But we'll do the headline at least. Joe Biden accepts Democratic nomination and takes the fight to Donald Trump, saying he has, quote, cloaked America in darkness, and calling his failure on coronavirus unforgivable, as he offers an upbeat vision promising love and light and hope and light, unquote. They won't put it this way, I will. He spoke to the camera from the basically empty, massive Chase Center in Wilmington, Delaware, attended only by less than three dozen reporters and a few staff to keep Biden on target, and of course to make darn sure that the teleprompter was working properly. They say things like, he vowed to be an American president who would work hard even for his opponents. Well, that is after he kills those who won't turn over their guns, put on their masks, and take their poke. The high tone, they say, comes after the first 3 days of the four-day event focused on bashing Donald Trump as unfit to lead. Although they know he did say he failed to protect America and the nation was facing, quote, one of the most difficult moments America has ever faced, which may be the only thing he said that was actually true, but certainly not for the reasons they try to get you to believe. And their coverage starts off with this quote, too much anger, too much fear, too much division, said Biden early in his remarks, which he framed around an epic battle of light versus darkness. I was next going to go to the New York Times coverage, but hey, the WAPO tells us democracy dies in darkness. And since we were never supposed to have a democracy to begin with, if we did have a constitution, maybe that's what should happen. They didn't really even focus, though, on how wonderful Biden was and the fact that he didn't make any horrible gaffes. Their headlines say things like this, Trump scandals and three other talking points that the Democrats mostly left out this week. Yeah, they weren't nasty enough to the bad guy, Orange Man Bad. How about this one? On the opinion side of the front page. Yeah, folks, there's a side. Our democracy in peril, says the first one. Trump's re-election strategy rests on two huge falsehoods. The next one already has Biden in there. That's kind of funny. I wonder if they really think he's going to make it past the inauguration and remember where he's supposed to put his hands. Anyway, power ranking, it says, here's who Biden should pick for his dream cabinet. You can probably guess, even if you don't want to know. Because if they're evil with the right criminal connections, or anti-constitutional credentials, or just shiftless enough, they're on the list. Trump's latest threat shows he's trying to turn Election Day into chaos, says another headline. Oh yeah, and the other big stories on the front page have to do with the Postal Service under fire for spurring worries about the delivery of ballots that will compromise the November election. Oh, and we can't forget this. They've even got a big headline announcement up there for Trump on Trial, their investigation, which they say will lay bare Trump's fixation on Biden, to be published August 25th. Oh, we can hardly wait. I'll admit, I do like the irony and the humor in this headline, too. Another opinion piece says, just imagine the answers Trump will give in the debates. Now, if you think about it, folks, that's all you're going to be able to do, because I can guarantee you one thing, there won't be live debates in front of a studio audience for reasons that'll be painfully obvious to everybody except those who are trying to cover up the obvious reason why. But when it comes to shameless, transparent gushing, it really is hard to beat the toilet paper of record. Ah, here we go. From the New York Times. With the speech of his life, says the headline from Frank Bruni, Joe Biden becomes the man for this moment. Yes, a country in pain, it says, gets a lesson in perseverance. Oh, and we'll come back to this one, folks, in a minute. If for no other reason than the bile needs to go back down. How about this one? Watch the four moments, they gush, that mattered on the fourth night of the DNC. Two of our correspondents break down the highlights from the Democrats' first virtual convention. And it starts like this. And I'll read just as much as I can stomach, which won't be a lot. It says, Adam Nagorny. Okay, wow, so much to say. First, we're going to get to Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s speech in depth for sure, because that was quite a moment. A lot of people were worried that the convention would overshadow the party's 77-year-old candidate, Barack Obama, the roll call, Michelle Obama. But these four virtual days will, I would wager, be remembered for a long time because of the speech that Mr. Biden gave. If there was a room, I suspect he would have blown it away.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, yeah, okay, wow. And you know what, folks? Note that that song snippet says, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it. And that's especially true when it comes to Biden's speech. Do we really know who gave it, when he gave it, and how many takes it took? How many witnesses are there? And do you trust any of them to tell you? Ah, well, we'll come back to that concept, too. But first, Jenny Medina says this. You know, I've hardly covered political conventions, IRL, but I've watched many on television. And I have to say, I found this to be far more engaging than what I've seen in the past. It was impossible, though, she says, not to be moved by Mr. Biden's speech. The rest of the piece has them trying to outgush one another, like this from Adam. I've rarely seen a convention speech set up a fall campaign as effectively as that one. Voters could not ask for a sharper choice, blah, blah, blah. Mr. Biden kept using the motif of light and darkness. He was optimistic even as he acknowledged the enormity of the plandemic, a real contrast with Mr. Trump's dark acceptance speech in 2016, blah-de-blah-de-blah. And here I have to tell my own personal story. I got a link to something I actually never do, and that was watch a music video, which I could care less about and don't know who this was, but for reasons that don't really bear on the discussion directly, I watched a couple of minutes of it. It was loud, vapid, and full of the usual tripe, which was kind of the point of the exercise, of course. But then I watched the Biden acceptance speech, and I saw why it was, maybe subliminally, I was moved to connect the two, because it occurred to me that I had watched a music video twice in a row. And the first one, loud, noxious, and vapid as it was at least better choreographed than the second. It leads me to make this observation, folks. Joe Biden is the music video candidate. And if they're successful in stealing this election, he'll be the music video dictator, lip-syncing to something that was pre-recorded. How many takes did it take? You'll have no idea. You don't even know whether what you're seeing on the screen there is real or not, where it was photographed, and how it was edited. And that's the key. And that's really why we're talking no debates. And this virtual campaign is kind of a whole new era for American politics with a virtual candidate. Which takes me back, as I promised, to this opinion piece from Frank Bruni about how Joe Biden gave the speech of his life. And he says this, and I can't help but agree, at least in part. Let's be honest. One of the big questions attending Joe Biden's big speech at the Democratic National Convention was whether he still had enough gas and enough grip. No, he doesn't say it right. I will. Whether he still had two brain cells to connect together to get to the end of it without losing velocity or swerving this way and that. Guess what he said? He did. He absolutely did. It's true. Is he in the fleetest, shiniest, nimblest form of his very long career? No. But Donald Trump's no Ferrari either. And we're so happy that he didn't drool on the podium. I guess the big news of the night, folks, was that Joe didn't embarrass himself, even though they had to make sure he did it in front of an empty room, just in case. And perhaps surprisingly, the most appropriate line of the night came from the Communist News Network, where Van Jones let the cat out of the bag, says Christina Layla for the Gateway Pundit. The Democrat media complex obviously set the bar really low for creepy Joe Biden's acceptance speech, and Van Jones basically came right out and admitted it, quote, "And we were prepared for it to be a terrible speech. As long as he didn't embarrass himself, we were going to come out here and praise it," unquote. But you know what, folks? You really do have to hear it in context.
And that sound that you hear all across the country is the sound of Democrats exhaling. That's what that is. People would have accepted anything. We just wanted Joe to get out there. So, you know, sometimes when he gets out there, you're afraid he's going to make a mistake. He's going to have a gaffe. The expectations are just so low. And then he came out there and he gave an extraordinary speech.
Yeah, folks, he may not be able to connect two thoughts together coherently, but he can still read from a teleprompter. And you know what? So far as the talking heads are concerned, that says it all. Really, that's all he needs to be able to do. Read his lines. Okay, Van Jones goes on to gush a bit more and then says this.
It was an extraordinary speech. And we were prepared for it to be a terrible speech. As long as he didn't embarrass himself, we were going to come out here and praise it. You don't have to make nothing up tonight. Joe Biden did that thing tonight. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah, folks, that pretty well summarizes it. Unbelievable. And that tells you all you need to know about the state of politics in post-constitutional America. And I really do kind of wish that was the end of it, folks, but we all know it's not. Let's do what remaining recap we need to in more or less reverse chronological order. Some of you may remember that Barry Sabarco, a.k.a. Barry Sotero, a.k.a. Barack Hussein Obama, had at least two radical communist mentors in his early life. One, of course, racemonger and strident communist Frank Marshall Davis, who got to him in a whole bunch of ways while he was really young and impressionable. And the other, one of the most radical revolutionary socialists of the 20th century, Saul Alinsky, who, in his famous book, Rules for Radicals, made it a tribute to, and I'm quoting from the intro, the first radical known to man who rebelled against the establishment and did it so effectively that he at least won his own kingdom, Lucifer. He's also known, of course, as the Great Deceiver, among other things. And that, at least, was reflected very clearly in Barry's speech at the Communist Party USA virtual convention Wednesday night. And it also demonstrates quite effectively another one of Alinsky's major tenets. I think he stole it from Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, where it was called The Big Lie. And a major part of that boils down to accuse your enemies of exactly what you're up to.
So at a minimum, we should expect a president to feel a sense of responsibility for the safety and welfare of all 330 million of us, regardless of what we look like, how we worship, who we love, how much money we have, or who we voted for.
Oh, do you think that was a whopper? He's just getting rolling.
But we should also expect a president to be the custodian of this democracy.
Ah, come on. You'd think a guy that prattles on about how he taught constitutional law would at least know what form of government we actually had and what form of government the founders called the devil's own. But hey, there is a certain parallel here, isn't there?
We should expect that regardless of ego, ambition, or political beliefs, the president will preserve, protect, and defend the freedoms and ideals that so many Americans marched for, went to jail for, fought for, and died for.
Like the freedom of speech, assembly, and worship? Like the God-given constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms that this guy famously, well, the politest way to put it is, shat upon? Like the right to be free in your persons, houses, papers, and effect from unreasonable search and seizure, unless you're on Obama's enemies list? Or go to an airport?
I have sat in the Oval Office with both of the men who are running for president. I never expected that my successor would embrace my vision or continue my policies.
Because after all, I had him bugged for months. Why, that's why I sicked the FBI on him and worked so hard on this coup.
I did hope, for the sake of our country, that Donald Trump might show some interest in taking the job seriously.
What do you say to that? Obviously, though, he means completing the destruction of the Constitutional Republic. Finishing America off. finishing America with a C off and replacing it with America with a K. In other words, fundamentally transforming America. Remember what the man who would be king said just 5 days before he put his hand on a Bible and lied about fundamentally transforming the formerly constitutional republic?
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
But it just keeps getting deeper, folks.
Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job. Because he can't. And the consequences of that failure are severe.
Yeah, he has the usual deep state advisors. He's got some Bilderbergers, the Goldman Sachs crew, Big Pharma, of course, and he never fired my boy, Tony Fauci. But he just wouldn't toe the line. And we warned him and warned him. I'm going to skip over a whole lot of the BS about the senile creepy one and all of the criminality that Obama knows about but isn't about to tell the audience. And fast forward to this particularly noxious whopper.
But more than anything, what I know about Joe, what I know about Kamala, is that they actually care about every American.
Well, unless you're one of those bitter clingers, and you know who you are.
And that they care deeply about this democracy.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Ah, come on.
They believe that in a democracy, the right to vote is sacred.
Whereas your right to keep and bear arms isn't worth the GD piece of paper it's printed on.
They believe that no one, including the president, is above the law.
But remember, the law is what I say it is. And my three-letter agencies will do exactly what I want them to, and ordered them to, and you're never going to find out about it once we get our people back where they belong.
And that no public official, including the president, should use their office to enrich themselves or their supporters.
That's what sons are for. Just ask Hunter Biden.
This president and those in power, those who benefit from keeping things the way they are counting on your cynicism.
Oh, trust me, folks. They've got it. They've earned it.
They know they can't win you over with their policies. So they're hoping to make it as hard as possible for you to vote and to convince you that your vote does not matter.
Because if we've been able to prove anything to you over the last 4 years, it's that your vote didn't make a darn bit of difference, and we're continuing to get away with what we were getting away with before, and once we finish the coup, you'll never hear about it again.
That is how they get to keep making decisions that affect your life and the lives of the people you love.
And right there, folks, is a downright incredible example of reduction to practice, of what Barry learned at the knee of Saul Alinsky. Deception is the key to everything. Say one thing, do another. Even change the meanings of words. All that matters is power. You do anything to get it, and you certainly do anything to hang on to it.
You can give our democracy new meaning.
Yeah, let that sink in for a second.
This administration has shown it will tear our democracy down if that's what it takes for them to win.
We, on the other hand, will destroy your jobs and then burn and loot your cities if that's what it takes to win.
So we have to get busy.
Oh, yeah.
By voting like never before.
Vote early, vote often.
So that we leave no doubt about what this country that we love stands for.
And it's got nothing to do with that God and those unalienable rights that he gave each and every one of us, that this government was instituted among men to secure, and that a whole bunch of far better people than this scumbag once pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to birth. Oh yeah, make no mistake, they're fundamentally transforming it into something a whole hell of a lot more like a literal hell on earth. From there we go to a story that certainly has been censored, but it goes to show the degree of perfidy we're dealing with here. This comes from investigative reporter par excellence Jack Cashill via the American Thinker, and it has to do with his new book called Unmasking Obama, The Fight to Tell the True Story of a Failed Presidency. And he said he thought at some length about whether or not to address the question of Barack Hussein Obama's sexuality. But two considerations, says Cashill, persuaded me to pursue the issue. One was the no-holds-barred media treatment of the sex life, real and imagined, of first candidate and then President Donald Trump, and, of course, Brett Kavanaugh. The second was the fact that despite Obama's early feint to the center, yeah, sure, Anybody actually still remember that? The Obama regime was something of a golden age for gay America. And a May 2012 Newsweek cover story, in fact, dubbed Obama the first gay president, which is about as close as they get to telling the truth. Originally, he noted, the fear of offending what they call the black church made Obama initially cautious about championing the LGBTQ, etc. cause, but there may have been another reason, now obvious, for his restraint, because he faced rumors that he himself was gay. And this may have cost one prominent comedian her life, your host interjects here, that Michelle, or maybe Mikey, was, as she put it, a tranny. By the way, folks, Cashel doesn't even note what most of us have heard, that Bathhouse Barry was famously called that in Chicago for obvious reasons. But he does say that no subject made those closest to Obama more nervous. Here Cashel quotes college girlfriend Alex McNear, who redacted a section of a letter that she shared with Obama biographer David Garrow, thinking that Obama's reflections on his homosexuality were too explosive. Her concern was understandable, because in his early 20s, Obama had written to McNear that he viewed gay sex as, quote, an attempt to remove oneself from the present, a refusal perhaps to perpetuate the endless farce of earthly life. And the man who would be king continued, you see, I make love to men daily, but in the imagination. My mind is androgynous to a great extent, and I hope to make it more so, unquote. And it seems like he succeeded, or maybe even went way too far. This passage, however, did not make the hardcover edition of Garrow's 2017 book entitled Rising Star. And remember, in the less inclusive days of the early 1980s, no straight guy I know of, says Cashel, would have even thought to make such an admission, especially to what they call a girlfriend. And only after McNear finally sold the Barack Obama letter in 2016 to Emory University was Garrow able to access the original, and even then with some difficulty. But finally, Garrow, the Pulitzer Prize-winning civil rights historian, did include the passage in the paperback version of his book, but no one even noticed. He goes on to describe the admitted bisexuality of Obama's so-called mentor, Frank Marshall Davis. He quotes an excerpt from a poem entitled Pop, Obama wrote about the man while he was in college, that I'm not going to quote, but suffice it to say, it makes his case. And, of course, after Obama announced his run for the presidency in 2007, a fellow named Larry Sinclair fueled rumors about Obama's sexuality when he went public with his allegations of a two-day coke and sex binge with the then-married Obama back in 1999. After which he booked space at the National Press Club in June of 2008 to detail his reputed relationship with Obama. But from the beginning, the waystream media, including what he called the responsible right, pretended that Sinclair didn't even exist, while they left the actual work of extinguishing the man's credibility to the leftist internal hitmen. Sinclair, though, did refuse to buckle, held his conference, and watching it years later, said Cashel, I'm impressed by how well Sinclair understood Obama's hold on the media. If you ask a question about a black man who tries to run for president, he observed, all of a sudden, you're called a racist, a bigot, unquote. And those words were certainly prescient now, weren't they, folks? He goes on to describe at some length the attempts by the waystream, including Politico et al., to try to discredit Sinclair, finally noting that, hey, as ought to be obvious, the media had stunningly different standards for a man like Sinclair and, say, well, a Stormy Daniels or a Christine Blasey Ford. Is this the same media that insisted we believe the women, but we're not at all inclined to believe the men, even if they're gay? The same media who insisted that love is love somehow saw something inherently distasteful in Sinclair's tale of consensual gay sex. Yes, notes Cashel, Obama did get married, although he does refrain from calling him her a beard. He does note, though, that the memoir, Dreams from My Father, culminates in his wedding to Michelle, but he seems to have chosen her with the same political calculations that he chose his church, a way of rooting himself in the African-American community. And as with all of his previous relationships, that he talks about anyway, this tale of courtship is strikingly devoid of any reference to love, romance, or even sex. There's a message here, folks. And like so much else that the waystream and their socialist media counterparts don't want you to hear, the message you're not hearing is arguably far more important than the one they're pushing. Which takes us to the bottom of the hour break, after which we'll change gears, even though the warning remains consistent.
There's going to be the devil to pay. All you sinners, don't you know that you ought to know Satan
heaven's waiting for you deep in the down below. Below, you can go to that church on Sunday. You can wash all your sins away. But if you're only really good on one day, it's gonna be the devil to pay. Oh, live it up, lab it up, judgment's coming. It's gonna be the devil to pay. Gonna get you today. Gonna be the devil to pay.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and there is more going on than just the virtual communist revolution playing out on TV screens and the real communist revolution playing out in places like Chicago, New York, and of course, Portland and Seattle. And everywhere you see people being led like sheep to the slaughter, wearing their face muzzles like good little slaves, you can kind of see what I mean. Not too long ago, of course, America's Dr. Mengele, a.k.a. Tony Fauci, said something that will no doubt be appropriate as we look back on these times. Basically, he thinks maybe face masks aren't enough. People might need to wear goggles, too. And your host has said, admittedly, somewhat in disgust, that if Big Brother tried to make people wear Groucho glasses, along with the nose and mustache, most of the sheep no doubt would. Just like they've put up with being slowly disarmed, virtual rape at airports, and they'll bend over like cattle for the vaccine, too. We saw another example of what that meant this week. And no, it didn't come from the Babylon Bee, but we'll get there as well. Via Zero Hedge, Paul Joseph Watson, Summit News, and others, the governor of Maine has recently ordered restaurant staff, for those few that are actually going to try to reopen, to wear anti-COVID visors upside down. And since you may not know or even believe what I'm talking about, let's read the actual decree from on high. It says, quote, front of house staff in restaurants who choose to wear face shields must now wear them upside down so that they're attached at the collar instead of the forehead. That means their breath is directed up, not down, unquote. And some people say, hey, the idiot forgot that there are such things as fans and air conditioning and ducts that move breath all around. So who's she kidding? And maybe Janet Mills has never actually worked in a restaurant, or worked for a living for that matter, so she might not have figured out that a person who's serving food might have to be able to see their feet, or the food that they're serving, or what they might trip over. But hey, that has nothing to do anymore with what's going on in America with a K now, does it? Quote, it's another ridiculous and pointless measure, well, unless you realize the real point, says Dave Blount, as a symbol of submission, forcing us to obliterate our individuality, wearing masks was simply not explicit enough. So they pushed the envelope even further. No one can miss the significance of making people wear dog cones. And it's kind of hard to argue with that. But when it comes to seeing just how bad it could and probably will get, let's go down under. From Natural News first, medical fascism, says the headline. Australian Prime Minister claims that everyone, whether they like it or not, will take the vaccine or else. Scott Morrison, the obese, vaccine-loving Prime Minister of Australia, begins, has now decreed that all Australians will need to be vaccinated for COVID-19 once the vaccine becomes available. Testing, of course, is no issue. And maybe there will be some medical exemptions. Isn't that nice of them? Said Morrison to Melbourne radio station 3AW, quote, I would expect it to be as mandatory as you could possibly make it. Quick aside here. Doesn't that sound like he's saying, if you don't obey, we will kill you? And it says the Australian government has already, at least reportedly, secured an international deal with Swedish-British pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca to produce the vaccine candidate currently under development. And you already know, don't you, that that deal will make them liability-free for any and all the deaths that follow. And as soon as it breezes through the clinical trials, such as they'll be, it'll be made free. That's the kind of free you don't want for all Aussies, meaning, of course, that somebody will print the money and taxpayers will ultimately foot the bill. And for those that are already getting conditioned to the no-mask, no-service policies being implemented by grocery stores, airlines, and even state governors in so many cases around the formerly free United States, not to mention down under, you can expect mandatory vaccines everywhere to follow mandatory masks. And you know they won't call them mandatory policies. You just won't be allowed to buy or sell without them. And Socialist Australia may beat the formerly free United States to the cash-free punch as well. Two stories. First one from the Daily Mail Online about how Australia's four big banksters have removed thousands of ATMs and shut down hundreds of branches as the, well, supposedly anyway, COVID-1984 crisis, or the socialists that are pushing it, push the nation closer and closer towards a cashless society. The number of ATMs in the nation continues to decline, bringing the number of ATMs across the nation to its lowest level in 12 years, just over 25,000, and at least 2,150 terminals have been removed during the recent June quarter, according to the Australian Payments Network. And their four big banks, ANZ, Commonwealth, NAB, and Westpac, have also shut a combined 175 branches in the last year. And we follow up with this from Zero Hedge. Australia's 5 and 10 cent coins could bite the dust as well, as the COVID-1984 pandemic has supercharged the decline of coin circulation. Ross McDermott, CEO of the Royal Australian Mint, told ABC News that he expects the 5 and 10 cent coins to be phased out of circulation over coming years, adding that the pandemic has likely shortened the life of the coins. And the reaction will shorten the lives of everybody else. From there, a warning masquerading as good news, also courtesy of Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, about how the COVID-1984 pandemic may be rolling over. Back on July 14, it begins when a wave of new COVID cases was, at least allegedly, sweeping the Sunbelt states, prompting many to speculate that a new round of shutdowns was imminent, along with other draconian measures. We took the other side of the argument, says Tyler Durden, and claimed that the pandemic peak had hit, and that in Arizona, an early recent outbreak state, the worst was over for the COVID breakout. Well, we were right, as Bank of America confirms today. Arizona has seen a 66% decline since its peak on July 14th, while the U.S., excluding the four major recent outbreak states, including Arizona again, but also the left coast of California, Florida, and Texas, are otherwise experiencing a 13% decline in claimed cases, at least, since the peak on July 30th. The number of hospitalizations is rolling over, too. And there's more. As B of A points out, quote, we continue to see clear signs the coronavirus is rolling over in the U.S. as the number of people hospitalized due to COVID-19 declines at a rapid pace of about 1% a day, actually 26% over 23 days, meaning that there might in fact be zero COVID-related hospitalizations by the November 3rd election day. And you know what that means, don't you? Yeah, folks, expect another hammer to fall. Speaking of hammer and sickle, we did pretty well talk about the DNC convention during the first segment. There was this hammer that fell, courtesy of Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit, again concerning election fraud. Twitter is on a suspension rampage. Last week, they suspended top Trump supporter and very popular conservative Bill Mitchell. And this week, they followed that up by suspending none other than the Babylon Bee, a conservative satire website that's been surging in popularity, and that had to be stopped, because as you know, folks, satire is one of the most famous and foremost weapons against the kind of tyranny we're seeing, so that must not be allowed. The Babylon Bee had this to say about it. A large number of conservative and satirical Twitter accounts that criticize the left were shut down yesterday in what CEO Jack Dorsey says was a totally honest mistake. Dorsey claims that an intern set their coffee on a button that was clearly labeled Destroy All Conservatives, located in the commons area near the coffee machine and thus easy to miss if you're not paying attention. Quote, it's right there where people are always setting their coffee. New guys sit it all the time. There's no ill will meant. It's just a button. Total mistake, he told reporters, and asked why they would install such a button in the first place. Dorsey said, I believe we installed that as part of our non-approved humor eradication protocol. I don't know. If you ask me, Twitter may have been a bit aggressive about banning people on the right. He was asked if the button would be removed to prevent future incidents and replied, oh, no, nope, it's staying, but we will be extra careful. Promise. Later, they did say this, without the usual sarcasm. For those who are unaware, we were suspended from Twitter earlier in the week for spam and platform manipulation. Yeah, they said the suspension was brief, maybe 90 minutes, but it immediately launched a firestorm, and we were deeply moved by the outspoken support from people who like what we do, whether Christian or atheist, conservative or liberal. Thanks to the outcry, Twitter quickly reinstated our account, but it might not go down like that next time. And Kyle Mann noted that we were not alone in our suspension. Plenty of others joined them. And they, like all the rest of us, do know this is a continuing battle. And while I'm looking at the site, I can't help but note a whole bunch of other headlines that ought to at least inspire a chuckle or two, like this one. Study finds most Americans trust Dr. Pepper over Dr. Fauci. Here's a picture about the internet that says, oops, public school teacher forgets to remove Antifa mask. Related item, overachieving father actually knows all of his kids' names and ages. New slogan from the Joe Camel campaign, I'll be dead in the cold, cold ground before a black woman becomes president. BLM rioters awarded Nobel Peace Prize. And sadly, folks, that hasn't been satire for years now. There are a couple on Postalgate, like Democrat mailer promoting mail-in voting gets lost in the mail. And I like this one. Brilliant, Trump puts himself on all postage stamps, forcing Democrats to now push to abolish U.S. Postal Service. Let's call this one Conspiracy Theory Revealed. Democrats lure progressive voters to the polls by disguising them as riots. And with some of these folks, it's too bad you can't see the pictures that go with the headlines. The Babylon Bee did have several salient points to make about the Communist Party convention masquerading as virtual Democrats. And no surprise, there was far more truth in the satire than the speeches. Poll finds most Americans would rather jump into a volcano full of angry geese than watch DNC convention. Live interview, Democratic convention viewer wishing they would just get to the part about all the free stuff. Dateline Wilmington, Delaware, in a live stream celebrating his nomination, Joe Biden proudly declared that his physician has declared him clear of Alzheimer's, dementia, and Alzheimer's. Quote, my doc says I don't have Alzheimer's, dementia, or Alzheimer's, he said confidently. Oh, and he also cleared me of Alzheimer's. Wait, who are you people? What are all these cameras doing here? Who am I? But after AIDS calmed him down, and just before they were finally able to cut the feed, Biden added, my doc says I don't have Alzheimer's, dementia, or Alzheimer's. And the press quickly praised the speech as one of Biden's most coherent. Well, that is, up until his masterpiece presentation on Thursday, when he managed not to say anything catastrophically incoherent. We'll start to move back towards the real news with a piece that could have certainly come from the Babylon Bee, but didn't. I guess it shows how difficult it is to write satire in a nation gone completely nuts. Everybody knows what NIMBY stands for, right? Not in my backyard. And as Zero Hedge puts it, that's long been a fixture of the ultra-far-left Golden State, where it's typical to see things like, we want to ban all of you peons' guns, but when it comes to Hollywood hypocrites and other hoi polloi, but when it comes to our own heavily armed bodyguards, well, we're deserving of stuff that you're not. And that's true of the mayor of Chicago as well. Lori Lightfoot, who's famous for encouraging local Black Lives Matter protests, because she still pushes the official narrative that they're peaceful, don't you know? And who also went so far as to say that black lives are, quote, more important than downtown corporations after the unprecedented looting that took place last week, defended something that some might say just smacked of a teensy bit of hypocrisy. She defended the Chicago Police Department's ban on protesters being able to demonstrate on her block, saying, and I'm quoting, and this is not the Babylon Bee, remember, I have a right to make sure that my home is secure, unquote. I guess it's just too bad for you peons that the Bill of Rights doesn't apply to you anymore. But yeah, I have a right to make sure my home is secure. You see, some animals really are more equal than others. But she believes that the dumbed-down residents of Chicago who are stupid enough to put her in that mansion actually will buy what she's peddling now. Quote, I think that residents of this city, understanding the nature of the threats that we are receiving on a daily basis, understand that I have a right to make sure that my home is secure, unquote. Yeah, not you folks. You don't have any rights. Obviously, notes Tyler Durden, when it comes to outrageous levels of liberal hypocrisy, things get complicated. And no satire can really do it justice, because the truth is far, far worse than anything you'd even want to joke about. And by the way, aside from the expanded police presence to block protesters from even reaching anywhere close to her home, Lightfoot already receives 24/7 protection from cops, including officers stationed at the residence. In other words, this is on top of that. Oh, and worse, the aggressive over-policing of the self-absorbed hypocrite, that would be the mayor, has siphoned away resources from the area's police district. And some sources, knowledgeable of the situation, told the Chicago Tribune that this has led to, quote, quiet grumbling. You know, folks, it may have been that kind of quiet grumbling that led to the French Revolution. There were some high-profile arrests this week of people connected with Trump and or conservatism and the Constitution that may or may not have had suspicious timing. On the eve of the release of her new documentary entitled Shadowgate, which was later banned from YouTube, no surprise, conservative filmmaker and reporter Millie Weaver, sometimes known on the web as Millennial Millie, was arrested at her home in Ohio and arraigned on Monday for alleged felonies that the alleged victims say weren't, Well, later in the week, former trusted Trump aide Steve Bannon was arrested and indicted over allegedly ripping off a $25 million crowdfunded border wall, which all of those people who, oh so coincidentally, were having their big finale never wanted to happen anyway.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
I do want to make sure we get this one in today. It comes from Arush Sheva in Israel, IsraelNationalNews.com, about a professor, Udi Kimron, who they say will soon head the Department of Clinical Microbiology and Immunology at Tel Aviv University, and had this to say in an interview with Yediot Aharonot concerning the COVID-1984 booga 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 virus. Quote, "There is a very great interest for anyone who has supported the draconian measures taken around the world to say that Sweden's policy has failed. Because if it succeeded and trillions went down the drain for no reason, someone will have to answer for it." Well, he could be excused for getting that one wrong, folks, because when trillions go down the drain, some really nasty critters who live in the swamp below profit massively. And as you know the old saying, those who spoke up and try to stop it are the ones that get punished. But anyway, says Professor Kimron, "That is why all over the world they prefer to claim that Sweden was wrong, but in the end, the truth came to the surface. In a world where decision makers, their advisors, and the media were able to admit their mistake and the initial panic that gripped them, we would have long since returned to routine. The ongoing destruction due to the inability to admit this mistake, despite the epidemic's small mortality numbers, is outrageous," he said. "History will judge the hysteria." And that's a great line, folks. History will judge the hysteria. They put it in the headline. If we'd not been told that there was an epidemic in the country, you'd not have known there was such an epidemic, and you would have not done anything about it, he said emphatically. The fact that this issue runs all day in the media inflates it beyond its natural dimensions. If Black Death had raged here, as in the 14th century, you would not have had to follow the situation in the news. The bodies would have piled up in the streets. We were not, and we are not, in this situation today. Unquote. He noted that the total number of coronavirus deaths does not exceed 0.1% of the total population in any country, and the death rate from the COVID-1984 coronavirus is less than 0.01% of the total world population, meaning that 99.99% of the world's population has so far survived the plandemic, and the virus is negligibly lethal. The smart behavior, he noted, would be the opposite of what we do today. Populations not at risk should become infected and create chains of immunity, which would protect the sick and the elderly. But we are currently working for sweeping socialist distancing, which prevents such differential immunity, he added. And he went on to explain that infection of children is a welcome thing, or should be, because it protects at-risk populations. Quote, "For the same reason, I'd open up the whole education system, because the vast majority is made up of people who are not at risk." Yeah, he says a solution needs to be found for teachers suffering from things like diabetes or other background diseases, but I see no reason to prevent activities that encourage the economy, not only because it allows parents to go to work, but also because it lowers the mortality in the long run. And I would also, he said, and you know they're not going to talk about this, ask children and young people to take off their masks. Of course, he said, it is impossible to force a child to take off a mask, but proper information will do the job. He goes on to say that a whole bunch of the other things that are being done, I'm going to change the wording just a little bit, are downright stupid. And he added, these are things that got into our mind 4 months ago, and we do not understand that their time has passed, unquote. Or folks, that in some cases, they should never ever have come to begin with, unless you were looking to destroy, which seems to be exactly what the plan was all along. On to economics, then, and while the COVID-1984 pandemic is all about trying to distract people from the fact that the Federal Reserve teed this one up for literally decades, built the biggest debt bubble in human history, and then popped it, allowing those minions of Satan who walk in men's shoes and have the right inside information to profit incredibly, both on the way up and especially on the way down, and the biggest wealth transfer in history is now in progress, along with the greatest U.S. depression ever, by just about any metric you can think of, and certainly, of course, soon to come, the greatest money-printing spree, and ultimately, worldwide reserve currency collapse in history as well. First, a world trade update from Zero Hedge. Central banks expanded interventions to counteract the effects of the virus-induced global downturn, yeah, sure, and they've resulted in global equity prices at or near record high levels. Isn't that an amazing contradiction? Well, not if you think about it. These money wizards have printed trillions of dollars, plowing the money into financial markets to create an illusion that the worst global downturn on record is nothing more than a blip. You know, the V-shaped recovery coming real soon now to a theater, which is still closed, near you. However, the World Trade Organization, or WTO Goods Trade Barometer, registered a record low in June, confirming the decline in global merchandise trade in second quarter 2020 and suggesting that the recovery phase, to put it mildly, remains challenging. Additional indicators point to partial upticks in world trade and output in the third quarter, but the strength, they admit, of any such recovery remains highly uncertain. An L-shaped rather than V-shaped trajectory cannot be ruled out. Yes, folks, June registered an 18.5% decline in merchandise trade, and the current goods trade barometer is down 18.6 points year over year. Yes, it would seem, concludes Tyler Durden, the V-shaped recovery narrative is failing, and the so-called recoveries in the U.S., China, and Europe are all stalling. Which leads me to wrap things up today with a piece from Phoenix Capital Research, courtesy of a guy who's usually a pretty good chartist, but this week writes, "Welcome to the Global Gulag." Clive Mond, via his own site too, clivemond.com, says, "In case you haven't noticed, we now live under tyranny. And over the next several years, thanks to the unquestioning zombie-like submission of the masses, it's going to get a whole lot worse." When, he says, "this whole bizarre virus plandemic, or scamdemic too, started to gather momentum, I instinctively knew that something wasn't right, that the official explanations didn't add up, and that society at large was being played by those in power with an agenda. And to anyone with even a modicum of real intelligence, the whole thing stinks of an elaborate plot. So, driven by natural curiosity, and being a person who'd rather know the truth, however awful, than go around with blinders on, I embarked on a quest to find out what was really going on, what was behind all of this, and for what it's worth, I'm going to share my findings with you today. And because this is a pretty long piece, folks, with lots of good detail, I'm going to have to abbreviate some of it for time, but we'll certainly hit the high points, and I encourage you to read the whole thing. I understand," continues Clive Mond, "that there are those amongst you who are programmed by the system to label anyone who expresses views that deviate from the narrative, aka normal, as a conspiracy theorist. This, however, is conspiracy fact. Why was the virus, or maybe bioweapon, released when it was? The answer is simple. After years of exponentially increasing fiscal profligacy, debt across all levels of society had risen to wild, unsustainable extremes so that the world economic system was teetering on the verge of collapse. Witness the Fed's emergency interventions in the repo markets last fall. And if the system was about to collapse, those in power didn't want to take the blame for it, so they needed a scapegoat. Enter the virus. Oh, it wasn't our mismanagement that caused the system to implode. It was the virus. And the old Rahm Emanuel adage, never let a perfectly good crisis go to waste, has thus been embraced with gusto by those in power. For decades, in our relatively free societies, those able to plunder contented themselves with doing it economically, granting themselves inflated salaries, bonuses, and stock options, positions on boards, etc. But this virus scamdemic has presented them with an opportunity to wield what despots always really crave, raw, unbridled power over people, and the more they wield, the happier they are. They've now been given the opportunity to implement a totalitarian regime, and not just in one country or even one geographical region, but for the first time ever over the entire world. And this will have one distinct advantage over all previous totalitarian regimes to boot, that is, there'll be nobody left to fight back. Oh, and they've got Terminator-level technology too, folks. The window of opportunity for the ordinary citizen to prevent this from happening is already rapidly closing. Yeah, maybe he's too optimistic. And if the current apathy, indifference, and conformist stupidity of the masses, witness the masks, continues, their fate will be sealed as they become entombed in a global gulag. So who or what are the insanely, immensely powerful plutocratic forces intent on bringing about this global technocratic totalitarian regime? Understand first, though, that all the widely accepted leaders of society, including celebrities, the clergy, and politicians, are all marionettes, puppets. If they don't speak and act in accordance with the aims of the true masters of society, then they're marginalized or replaced. Special mention, though, has to go to the spokespersons for medical malpractice. And, of course, they have to be pro-vaccine. All right, so who are these people? Ask yourself a simple question. Who has the power to create unlimited wealth for themselves and their favorite associates at the touch of a few keystrokes? You got it. These central banks, who pass on the tab for their profligacy to society at large by steadily eroding the purchasing power of money. It's called inflation, folks, and you're going to see it gallop over upcoming months. All central banksters are subservient to it. Greg Mannarino even goes so far as to say that the Federal Reserve was behind the virus, and it's certainly easy to see why that might be the case. The central banksters and the leading, largely faceless men behind them are the true masters of the world, the real shadow government, and it's they who are behind this drive towards a global totalitarian society.